Hi, and welcome to Speak Your Truth Now. This is Amanda along with Mallory, and this week we're going to be taking a look back at the year and also be talking about some things that may be on the horizon for 2021. So we wanted to start off with an audio file that was sent to us, and I think it kind of sets up our topic pretty well. And so we'll go ahead and play that real quick.
I am a 29-year-old white woman. I grew up in the South, and I'm here to voice my truth. I've been unpacking racism and white privilege a lot in the past weeks, like so many of us, and have been gradually unpacking more and more white privilege over the past years, basically since I finished high school. And to be honest, I had never heard the phrase, nor I think rarely considered it until I began college. I just want to share some of what I've unpacked and some of my conclusions from it. And I think I'll speak about white privilege because I'm white and that's my experience. And I don't dare speak to another person's experience but mine and what I've learned and what I think that other white people need to process and realize and how we can move forward in our best way, realizing that we need to support everyone and that other people's burden has to be our own. I think that we're raised in school with this idea that if we do what is right and we work hard and we're kind to people, then things work out for us. And I also think that we're taught that racism is something that happened in the past. And I think that we're taught that, and here's something that I've learned that I think is key. If you are accused of being racist in any way, big or small, you're a bad person, right? So you are good, not racist, or you are bad, racist. Rather than what is clear now is that all white people are probably a little racist because you're white, because that's your experience. You have the experience of being white, and that's part of who you are, quite honestly. Most likely for the vast majority of people, because it might be likely that you were raised in a mostly white neighborhood with mostly white people around you, so you've grown up with terms like a good neighborhood or a bad neighborhood, or you know, what good guys and bad guys look like. And I think that's how racism gets taught to us, and there's many, many other ways, but this is not my own podcast, so I'm not going to hijack that. But I guess what I'm trying to say is we grow up thinking that if we do what is right, then everything will be okay for us. So we grow up and then we see other people who have issues, right? Who have so many troubles and have so many problems. And we see issues of race on the news, and we see issues of poverty, and we see people with big problems, right? And so often those people are disproportionately people of color. So we look at what our nice mom and dads taught us, who told us not to be racist and to be good people and to try hard and to work hard. And we say, well, they did something wrong, right? And mom and dad sort of say that. They sort of say, well, you know, if you live a life of crime, it's wrong. You did something wrong. So basically you get this idea that if you're struggling in the class system and in the system of race, it's your fault. And then that white people are doing something right. Basically, you're taught that you shouldn't be responsible for other people, and that if you didn't do anything wrong, then it's not your problem. I think that's just some of our system of selfishness as well, just taking care of ourselves. So the big and revolutionary thing that has to happen here is for white people to say, I didn't do anything wrong, but I have to take responsibility for everything. I wasn't taught overtly anything wrong, but I realize that there's a system that I've never experienced and I have to fix it. So white people have to suspend disbelief, listen to other people, people of color, completely, believe them completely, and accept responsibility for it. And I think it's just that suspension of disbelief and suspension of this clear idea of right and wrong that we need to break down. And we have to do that through, you know, I think the easiest thing and the hardest thing to do is conversations with family. you would think it would be so easy, but I think it's so hard. I think a lot of us experience that. So we need to start, we have to take responsibility for that, because I look at my own family and I suddenly realize that I think the vast majority of them don't necessarily believe in white privilege or think that it's their problem. So I have to take that as my problem, to do my best with that. We have to engage. We have to do so much more than vote. We have to donate. We have to join a committee. We have to get something done and use your privilege and your leverage to help our neighborhood and our whole family, no matter what color. So that's my 10 cents for this podcast.
Yeah, so I think that Lauren in her audio file touched on a lot of really good topics about white privilege and how a lot of white Americans are brought up and the things that they're taught when they're younger. And so I kind of wanted to go through some of those topics because I think a lot of what she says resonates with other people as well. And so to start off with, when she talks about white privilege, and that statement, she does say that she kind of started to unpack that and what white privilege was during what was happening with George Floyd and many other victims of police brutality this summer. But she also talked about, you know, the opportunity to kind of explore these types of topics when she went to college, which I think a lot of people can relate to because, you know, when you go to college, you're kind of leaving that community that you, you know, have gotten used to being around the same people, and going to college, you're exposed to a lot of different ideas and people from different places. I guess we should kind of describe what white privilege is. Mm-hmm. And I think, simply put, and Mallory, feel free to add to this, but it can be seen as like the societal advantage that comes with being what the norm is in America. Mm-hmm. So when I think about that, I think about like a WASP, like white Anglo-Saxon, yeah, Protestant, and, you know, white men to be more exact. That's obviously not bringing any other factors into play, like wealth, gender, or anything like that. And I know a lot of people have had conversations around white privilege, you know, this past summer and up till now.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the most important things to note about white privilege is, you know, like, it's not saying that your life hasn't been hard. It's saying that your life has not been hard because you are white. You know, you haven't faced, you know, barriers in education or healthcare or housing, or even just, you know, walking down the street to, you know, go get something from Quick Trip or whatever. So it's the idea that your life has not been harder because of your race. Whereas for people who are not white, that probably will not always be true. So I think that's one of the more important things to note about white privilege, because I think, you know, a lot of white people, whenever they're first confronted with this idea, they're like, well, what do you mean? You know, you don't know about my life. You don't know about my struggles. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. But those struggles, you know, they only went so far because of your race, because, you know, you were white, you know, and, you know, if you were, you know, caught cheating on a test, let's say in high school, and you were white, maybe your teacher's more inclined to look the other way because you're a good student normally, or you're stressed, or whatever it might be. Whereas, you know, if a black or brown kid had been caught doing that same thing, cheating, you know, in high school, then that may not, you know, they may not have gotten off with just a slap on the wrist. So, you know, like, it's not saying that your life isn't hard. It's saying that you have certain privileges and a way to navigate the world that shields you from a lot of the harsh realities.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because we do hear that a lot in conversations when we try to explain privilege to people. And yeah, I think it's important to say that everybody has privilege in different areas. And, you know, mm-hmm. It can make life smoother for you in certain situations. And, you know, we also talk about privilege, you know, when it comes to money, wealth, and whatnot, and privilege because of your skin color, the shade of your skin, even within like mm-hmm. the black and brown communities. And so there's a lot of different ways that we can have privilege in different aspects or in different social categories. And another thing that Lauren talked about in her audio file was about how, when you're brought up as a young kid in America, for the most part, the majority of people are brought up believing that good things happen to good people, kind of like the American dream idea, too, that if you work hard and you're a good person and you obey the law and follow the rules, that you'll have a good life. And people that don't do well or have struggles or addictions or are poor or, have mental disorders or whatever it might be, there's something wrong with those people. That something happened to them. Maybe they didn't try hard enough, And so I think that was really an important point to make, is that a lot of people can sometimes overlook these disadvantaged groups because they have perceptions of how they're living their life, and maybe this fallacy that they have more control over their life than they really did, or that everything negative that's happened to them has been because they did something bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people after the summer are starting to see their, the idea of life in America and cops being there to protect you, and having all of these privileges. We're really starting to see this year that belief is crumbling for a lot of people, and they're starting to sort of see behind the facade that it's really not as good or neutral or whatever it might be as we are taught to believe when we're growing up. I think too, people are starting to learn how to listen to other people, I hope, listen to their life experiences and realize hey, I don't know that much about race. Maybe I should take the time to educate myself or listen to what other people are saying. So I think we, for a lot of people this summer, sort of the rug was pulled out underneath them, but in a good way, obviously. I feel like that expression has a negative connotation, but it was an awakening for a lot of people who weren't really aware prior to, the events of May and June.
Right. Yeah, I would agree. And another thing too, I think about some of like my privileges, and I think a privilege that I had was that I grew up in really racially diverse or ethnically diverse communities. And so, some of the things that Lauren talks about, I don't necessarily have experience with, but I can understand that some of us take for granted that a lot of Americans grow up in communities that look like them. They go to school with people that are like them. They go to church or go wherever, do sports, activities with people that look like them. And so, not even having those life experiences, like having relationships with people that are from a different background, whether it's race, religion, whatever. And how, if you don't have that exposure and things like that, that it's really hard to listen, like you said, to sit back and listen and not try to talk to things that you may not know about. And that's something that I forget a lot of the time, is how homogeneous a lot of our communities are in America, and how much of a privilege it is to like grow up living in different areas like I did, being a military brat and having to adjust to different cultures and things like that. You forget that that's not the lived experience of everyone else, and that a lot of people struggle with understanding different cultures and ethnicities and things like that, and just how important it is to have that exposure just makes it a lot easier to accept things like white privilege and to have conversations with people about white privilege.
And yeah, just real quick, this happens too. Let's say that, you grew up and you were around, if you were white and you grew up around a whole bunch of other white people, you went to school with them and church and so on and so forth. Even if your own community was, pretty homogenous, ideally, hopefully, you would still be getting some I don't want to say some culture in school, but you know, like some, you know, you would be like reading stories in your English class or in your history class and like learning about different groups, learning about people who do not look like you, whose life and whose life experiences do not look like your own. So like ideally, you know, school would sort of like, I don't know, bridge any gap between, you know, people growing up in like a really homogenous community and them, you know, getting to say like, oh, there is, you know, a life and life experiences outside of my own as a suburban middle class white person.
Right. Yeah. And I think this kind of segues really well into the rest of what we want to talk about, which is basically just systemic racism in general. We've talked about this in a lot of our episodes. It's kind of been just, you know, the underlying theme to everything that we've been discussing. And, you know, in the beginning, when we opened up and talked about George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, we talked about how the big culprit is systemic racism. And someone did ask the pod a couple of months ago, and so I wanted to follow back up on this, is, you know, how do we talk about systemic racism, and how do we talk about these types of things to well-meaning people? So, you know, well-meaning white people that are just neutral, which isn't a good thing to be anymore, right? Like, it's just not good to just say that you're a good person, like Lauren says. Like, a lot of people think, well, I was brought up to believe that, you know, treat others the way you want to be treated, et cetera, but that's just not good enough when you're dealing with topics like systemic racism and social justice. I really wanted to dive into how we can have these conversations with our well-meaning white friends, or maybe well-meaning black brown friends too, about systemic racism and really what it means and how can they, you know, combat it and to work with us as well to keep talking about these things and keep having these conversations.
Yeah, like I think we've mentioned this before whenever we've been like strategizing, you know, episodes for the podcast. Like we could do a whole season on systemic racism if we really wanted to. Like there's so many different aspects of it. Like it covers, you know, so much of our society and our institutions, like education, healthcare, housing, so on and so forth. Like it's truly embedded into damn near every facet and every, you know, institution in our society and our government. And so like it really, I think a lot of people, and this is not an excuse, but a lot of people get very overwhelmed by it and kind of want to like throw their hands up and be like, oh, well, systemic, that sounds like system. System is big. I can't change a whole system. I'm just one person, so I'm just not going to do anything, whatever. But I think, you know, you shouldn't be discouraged by, you know, feeling like it's, you know, overwhelming and pervasive because it is. And that's why you should be so fired up about it and why you should care and take, you know, concrete steps to address this and to, you know, affect positive change that, you know, you want to see out there. I mean, I think if people like are asking these questions, even if they are framing it as, I can't believe this is going on, I want to do better. I think that's, you know, that's awesome. It's something we should celebrate. You know, we can sit back later and critique, well, why did it take some people so long to get involved? Why did it take such a blatant and obvious injustice to occur? Like, why did it take something so obvious for you to wake up? I mean, we can get into that conversation later. But just like recognizing that, you know, people are wanting to put in the work, even if they aren't sure always how to do it perfectly, I think that's what we should honor.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, talking about systemic racism, that's why a lot of people have the issue with, you know, especially when we talk about cops, with the phrase, you know, bad apples, or, you know, they're just bad apples. We want to kind of get away from this idea that there are racist people, and racist people are everywhere, and some become cops and they do bad things and they make everybody else look bad. That's a fallacy, and it is systemic. It's embedded in our systems, like we've been talking about throughout this podcast. And so that's why there's a lot of frustration when we talk about bad apples, because once again, it kind of gets us away from the conversations about making big change. And once again, we're just trying to relegate it to one person and just saying, you know, that person, you know, was bad. And so we just need to weed those kind of people out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, really, so far, that hasn't been helping the situation when we think about racism in America. Like you said, systemic racism is found in education, housing, you know, healthcare, et cetera. We can see that even within education, you know, when it comes to school districts, they're really not as integrated as a lot of us believe them to be, that there still are school districts that are heavily segregated by race. And what I found was interesting too, and I'll link this in the notes to the episode, in a Washington Post article, they had some really cool data around this. But what I would normally think of is that in rural areas of America, there are probably more segregated school districts, more segregated communities. And when you move into the urban areas, you're going to have more diverse school districts. Well, that's true to an extent from the data that they talked about. But there are still many school districts within urban centers that are heavily segregated. And once again, kind of like going back into what we're talking about the importance of having those relationships with people that are different than you, having that exposure, having positive examples, positive memories to draw from when you think about these different racial, ethnic groups, et cetera, to kind of combat those stereotypes that you're going to encounter in the world. It's really important. And so even though America is becoming more diverse, and yes, you know, at some point, whites will not be the majority in America, we still have communities that are very segregated. And I think that's another thing to remember, because when we have those school districts that are segregated, then we get into, you know, funding and whatnot. And we can see that certain schools are getting better funding, they have better teachers going to those districts, they have better programs, they have more AP classes, et cetera, et cetera. And then people that are in those groups or in those areas, once again, they have that privilege of having a great education, having good funding, having good teachers, and that's giving them a leg up to the next phase in their life, you know, whether they're going to a trade school or university or going straight into the workforce. Just another example of how we can see privilege play out.
Yeah, absolutely. Like that's such a great point about, you know, the school districts. And like, I wasn't even aware, like you were saying, that there are some urban districts that are also pretty, you know, homogenous. That's not what you expect. One of the ways that I think is really helpful to look at systemic racism is if you take a quick look on the war on drugs, and we won't spend too much time on this. Like this, again, is a whole nother podcast season, really. But, you know, the statistic is, you know, white and black and brown people use drugs at about, you know, the same rates. But if you are black or brown, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to be arrested or convicted or charged or caught. And right. Face, you know, jail time for or whatever. But if you are a person of color, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to serve time for drugs, even though white people and people of color use drugs at the same rate. And then, you know, back in the, I believe it was in the 80s when we had, you know, mandatory minimum sentencing, when we got a whole bunch of people filled up in a bunch of prisons for what ultimately ended up being minor drug charges. And, you know, quotas and stuff like that. So like, it's not a matter of, you know, like looking at, you know, the statistics of, you know, people in jail and saying, oh, well, look, there's a lot of people of color in jail, therefore, they're more likely to use drugs. And when you actually take a look at the evidence, it's no, white people, people of color use drugs at the same rate, but you're more likely to be punished for it if you are a person of color. It has nothing to do with whether you use or not. It's how you're treated by the criminal justice system.
Yeah, from police to judges, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading this statistic I thought was really interesting, is that the United States, over the past 4 decades, which the war on drugs kind of started with Nixon, the U.S. has committed more than $1 trillion to the war on drugs.
Jesus.
And as we see, drugs are still a very serious problem in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though drugs are less accessible because they're most of them are illegal. And obviously, we've had a lot of really negative consequences from the war on drugs. Like you said, building up this whole system of generations of Black and brown people and white people in jail. And for a lot of minor offenses, minor drug related offenses. And it's something that we can definitely have a whole nother season on, like you said. Mm-hmm. But I did want to talk again about how do we make systemic racism more approachable for, you know, those well-meaning people and those that may not have had the exposure and experiences that we've had, and did want to make a point about, you know, other things that we should highlight is supporting Black communities. Mm-hmm. And I think you had a couple really good points on this.
Yeah, I think for me, like when it comes to supporting Black communities, the absolute best thing you can do as a white person or as a person of color who's not Black is to listen to what Black people are saying and listen to what the community is saying. Or if you're at a protest, listen to what the organizers of the protest are calling for and don't assume you know better. Like, you know, don't, you know, your job, you know, as a white person who, you know, wants to become more involved and wants to work on addressing systemic racism, your job is to listen to other people and not sit there and try to like disagree or play devil's advocate. Yeah, that's not your job. That's not what you're here for. You are here to listen to what, you know, people in the Black community are saying and what they're wanting and thinking about how you can go about and achieve that. And having hard conversations with, you know, other white people in your life about these sort of topics. Because from my own personal experience, I would say if you are a white person and you call out another white person on their racism, they're more likely to listen.
Right.
As f***ed up as that is, that's what I have found to be true. That doesn't make it right or anything like that, but it does make it all that much more important for you to not be that white person that lets them just sort of like slide, or, you know, who just ignores their behavior, whatever it might be, because you could very well be someone that comes along and helps them to start to change their mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, what you say about white people calling other white people out, I think is really important, because it's easier to hear it from someone of your same advantage group, I guess, because the idea is that there's no invested interest in that person, mm-hmm. you know, making that case for you. And so it kind of lends more credence or, you know, whatever, even though, it, like you said, it's not fair, but people may take a white man more seriously when he talks about, you know, racism in America versus, you know, a Black or brown person or another person of color. And so I think that's a really good point to make. And I think, like we said in a past episode, white people need to be talking to white people. And, you know, and also something that Lauren said that I thought was really important is it really starts with your family. And we've talked about this a lot. It's hard mm-hmm. to have these conversations. And that really where it really needs to start is with your family, with the people that are closest to you. And once you have that realization that, like you said, they may be well-meaning people and they may not be actively out there, you know, obviously being racist, we need everyone to be involved and actively speaking out against mm-hmm. racism. Like mm-hmm. a lot of people have been saying, we need people to be anti-racist, actively anti-racist.
And I think, like, you know, because like these conversations, like, they're not fun. They aren't, full stop. I'm not going to lie. But because they are often so unfun and frustrating, we can, you know, sort of get overwhelmed and feel like, well, they're never going to change. I throw my hands up, whatever, I'm done. But I think for me, it's been really helpful to pay attention to like small little changes I can see happening during the conversation. Like, even if, you know, the conversation doesn't end on a good note, or it doesn't end with me feeling like it was successful, there have been times where, like, okay, well, overall conversation, not so good. But I did notice that, you know, this person acknowledged this and this and such that. And so, you know, to just remember that it's very unlikely that you're going to change someone's whole worldview after one conversation. And just, you know, recognize and celebrate those tiny little changes you can see each time you have a conversation.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. You know, if you have to, like, keep, like, a schedule of, like, little goals for yourself and your conversation with that person, I think that's really helpful. Like, maybe a win for you is getting grandma to realize she can't say colored people anymore. Like, you know, like, meet people where they are.
Yes, exactly.
And so that may be the first step. And then, you know, white privilege may be, you know, 5 months down the road. 5 months, 5 years down the road, but it's something that you're actively working towards. And I think that's the important part is, like you said, you can't change somebody in just one conversation, and to just continue to have those conversations. And ultimately, you're doing something. You're doing something because you are changing someone's mind. And at the end of the day, that is a big difference. And, you know, think about all of the lives that one person touches and all of the interactions that they can be having with others, and having those conversations with people can really change how they interact with the rest of the world. And I know we've talked about this book, but also want to bring up So You Want to Talk About Race. And just a really good book, something to recommend to people who are especially wanting to kind of learn a little bit more about how they can have these conversations. And like we've said, it's a really good resource if you don't feel comfortable, you know, explaining what someone should do first, then get them this book or recommend it to them. And we participated in a book club about the book. A lot of people have been doing similar book clubs around, like, social justice books. Maybe you want to start a book club, or maybe you want to recommend this to a family member and then check in with them and talk about the book. I mean, there's just little things that you can do to kind of keep these conversations going.
Yeah. And, you know, there's so many resources out there. You know, Say You Want to Talk About Race is a great one. If you're feeling, like, overwhelmed with all of this, like, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. There's so many resources out there. And there's so many things you can consult that, you know, are designed exactly for having these hard conversations. So, like, it, you know, there's resources out there. There's things to back you up and to, you know, make you feel confident as you go into these conversations with folks.
Yeah. And I think a really big part of this, especially now that we're not in the summer of 2020, you know, where everything was happening and the protests were, you know, we're at the height of the protests and everyone was talking about these topics. I think it's really important to be responsible for yourself and the part that you're going to play in, you know, social justice, and just keep yourself accountable for those things, because it can be really easy to kind of ride those waves, you know, go to a protest or write a couple of, you know, Instagram posts, etc., maybe have a conversation with a coworker or a family member, and then you kind of just, you know, kind of let it go. It really isn't something that's going to be easy, and that you have to continue to work at it and continue to, you know, find ways to stay involved. And, you know, the more people that are talking about it, the better. So I think it's kind of a good opportunity to kind of look back on 2020. And we really started this podcast not that long ago, but it feels like so long ago. Really in the wake of, you know, what was going on. with George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, et cetera, all of the police brutality stories, and, you know, wanted to kind of plug back into that and talk again about how this situation in particular was such a catalyst for, you know, having these conversations and for the Black Lives Matter movement, and realizing that things have kind of calmed down a little bit, but that it's important to continue to have these conversations. And, you know, the George Floyd situation was very poignant and very disturbing for a lot of people to see just how blatant that was. But I hope that people can remember to be just as outraged about other situations that may not look and seem to be so cut and dry.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we've talked about this in an earlier episode, like, you know, part of the reason, you know, we think why so many people reacted so strongly to the George Floyd story is it was so obvious, like it was so cut and dry that, you know, the cop used excessive force and that he was not a danger and so on and so forth. Like, it, you know, it's a very cut and dry case. And, you know, that's not always the case, because life is not always cut and dry. And especially for, you know, like any future incidents that, you know, maybe, you know, you feel like, oh, what, well, maybe that person did have a criminal record, or they were in the middle of, you know, robbing a store. So, you know, it's to be expected that violence was used or whatever. And to, you know, remember that there's no such thing as a perfect victim of systemic racism, of police brutality, of anything like that. You know, in the years to come, in the months to come, that whenever we have more cases of police brutality and systemic racism that aren't as cut and dry as this one, that people, you know, remember the things they have learned during this time and don't rush to try to explain away a situation or explain maybe why someone else, you know, like why it was expected that they were a victim of police brutality or whatever it might be. And just to, you know, yeah, just to keep being committed to it and, you know, seeing it through and not giving up even when it gets really uncomfortable or hard for you.
Yeah. And, you know, as we're talking about trying to stay plugged in, I wanted to talk about some resources and some things that people can check out. You know, I think we talked about like joy and how important it is to have joy in these types of circumstances, and how it can be a way to resist. I think it's also really important to take a look back at situations that did cause you to act, that did disrupt your normal way of thinking. And the Washington Post had a really interesting graphic where they basically linked up all of the different protesting that was going on, you know, via video and images in the, you know, the days following George Floyd's death. And I thought that was really interesting to look at, because it kind of brought back to mind, that movement and how, you know, visceral it was and how many people were out there protesting, and, you know, the anger and the frustration and, you know, the hopelessness that a lot of people had, you know, that type of hopelessness that you have where, you know, all you feel like you have to do something. And so everybody tried to do something, whether it was, you know, protesting, donating, starting a podcast, you know, like things that we felt like we could contribute to the conversation. I think it was really interesting and important to look back on those protests too, especially, you know, maybe for those who haven't seen those images or haven't seen those things, or maybe you want to impress upon other people, you know, what the protests look like and what people were fighting for. I'll link that in the show notes, because I think that's really important. And of course, as always, I'm a big Washington Post fan, or as much of a fan as you can be of some mainstream media. And so they have a really cool section on racial reckoning, you know, and I check that out every now and then. There's some really good articles there. I believe we've talked about the book White Fragility, which, you know, like we said, that may be a recommendation for your grandma like 5 months later, but something that we would definitely recommend that you check out. And I just wanted to check in with you and see if you had any new resources or anything like that. I know we've talked about, obviously, Black Lives Matter, NAACP. We've
Oh.
talked about podcasts, etc.
Yeah, so I do, not to get off topic, but I fired up my Kindle to get some books from the library recently. I brought my Kindle back to life. But anyways, all that to say that it came up with a list of all my Kindle books. So, and I actually found a couple of short story collections on here that I got, I think for free actually over the summer when some publishers were giving away books on police brutality and systemic racism. So let me see. I think there's two. So there's two I have that I picked up that now that my Kindle is alive and well again, I will be reading. But one of them is called Who Do You Serve? Who Do You Protect? And it's an anthology that a couple of folks collected together. And it's about, as the title suggests, policing and, who are the police there to serve for? Who are they protecting? Spoiler, it's not you. It's, capitalism and white supremacy is what they're there to protect. And then the other one I got that I will be checking out in the upcoming year is, oh, my Kindle has gone rogue. The End of Policing by Alex S. Vital. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But as that one also suggests, the end of policing and an alternative to a world without policing. And so, so those are just ones that I got for, I think, free over the summer from a publisher that I will be checking out in the weeks to come. Because I don't know about you or anyone else listening, but like I find books are a good way for me to stay plugged into things because they are a little bit more like slow paced, but they're nice and in depth, and you can, revisit them, and they're always sort of there. So I find books very helpful.
Cool. I think there's some good ones. Thanks for sharing. So I think we'll go ahead and take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about 2021 and what's next and how, once again, to keep those conversations going. Twenty is drawing to a close. We have several days left, and I know that we're all looking forward to the new year.
Oh.
Hopefully things will get a little bit better, but of course we still have a pandemic raging, and so definitely want to make sure that we don't gloss over that and just how important it is to, stay safe, stay healthy, wear our masks, socially distance. This is really serious stuff. A lot of people are dying, and even though we do see vaccines on the horizon, people are dying every day, and that's not going to change for a very, very long time. So I think it's important to continue into 2021, basically doing the same things that we're doing now.
But with the promise of a vaccine on the horizon, like
Right.
there is an end to all this in sight finally. Thank God.
Right. And in the same way that we didn't stop talking about COVID after the election, like some people thought, we're not going to stop talking about social justice. And even though it's not as fun and as cool to see on Instagram anymore, we definitely want to continue to have those conversations. But we also just wanted to touch on a couple of positive things that have come out as far as, social justice in the last several months and, maybe things that are happening in 2021, just to kind of highlight that there are things that are changing and that the protests and the donations and the unrest and, people speaking up, it does have an impact and that we need to continue to do these things because they're important to actually see things change. One of those topics that we have talked about is defunding the police. And, obviously we've touched on this a little bit, how this is way more nuanced than a lot of people would like it to be. It's not as cut and dry as give the cops more money or give the cops less money. What it really comes down to is we want to pour resources into communities to help them, you know, help disadvantaged communities versus, you know, not having that money there, not having the money for social programs, social nets, helping those with disabilities, helping those with mental disorders, et cetera, those that, you know, don't have food to eat, people that don't have access to great education. I think that's what defunding the police really means. And, you know, kind of wanted to talk about what we're seeing as far as that, like money for social programs.
Yeah, you know, I think like one of the immediately tangible changes that happened this year was a lot of the cities, whenever they passed their annual budget, a lot of them, Philadelphia, I know, is one. Philadelphia, San Francisco, and I think New York. I know I'm forgetting some other cities, but several cities this year, whenever they did their annual budget, they allocated less funds than they usually would or what they had originally called for the police. They reallocated those funds somewhere else. And I know Denver is talking about starting to send more social workers out in response to certain 911 calls instead of sending cops out. Several cities have passed changes this year to, you know, reduce the amount of money that's going to cops and to send it back to other programs and groups in the community that could use it more. And I think, like, you know, I personally am hoping for a complete defunding of the police, but that's obviously not going to happen this year. And so, like, you know, a lot of people were like expecting like a big, huge, you know, change from like defund the police, cut their budget to $0. And so, like, you know, that's not the case. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately, in this case. But, you know, we have seen like little changes this year where funds are starting to go towards departments that could use them better and use them for more positive change and, you know, get the cops away from things they do not need to be involved in.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And there's a couple of things that I was reading about. There's, you know, multiple cities across America that are reducing police pay and overtime, which is like a big thing. So just little things like that. You know, there's a lot. Overtime is just rampant when it comes to the police or just policing in general. Like, it's very rare that a police officer works 40 hours a week. And a lot of that time, they are patrolling. And so while a lot of people would like to paint the picture that the cops are out there and catching bad guys that are stealing and things like that, that's not really the reality of what a normal cop does on a normal day. And being able to take that money, you know, not increasing cops' pay for the upcoming year, or putting a stop on overtime, that opens up a lot of money that can be put into other programs. And I think that that's really important. And of course, every community is different, you know, like it's not going to be, you know, let's take this much money away or this percentage of money away from every police budget or, you know, whatever. It is really dependent on the community and whatnot, but it's important for those local, you know, counties or cities or whatnot to look at their programs, see what is missing. Because at the end of the day, don't we want all of our fellow citizens to be living healthy, happy, prosperous lives? Like, if we're all doing well and we're all happy and we're all able to live a life where we can provide for ourselves and, you know, pay into our capitalist society, like that that is a good thing for everybody. I mean, I would think that people that are, you know, very pro-capitalist would think this way. They would be for creating and diverting funds towards these social programs, because at the end of the day, when we're over policing, You know, we're sending people to prison. We're sending people to jail. And what are people doing in prison and jail? They're doing nothing. They're not, you know, there are programs out there that I've read about that do really great things, but we're not sending people to jail to reform them. We're sending people to jail to punish them. And at the end of the day, what's the benefit in that to anybody in the simplest terms?
Yeah. Well, prison labor is beneficial if you're a horrible corporation, you have no ethics and no morals. Yeah. Right. Prison labor is pretty cool. And you'd probably want to see that continue. But yeah, no. And this might be getting a little bit too off topic, so I won't go too far down this rabbit hole. But you start talking about capitalism, and I hate capitalism, so I have to say something about capitalism. Mm-hmm. But you know, the idea, and like studies have shown this over and over again, if people's needs are met, if they have, you know, housing and food and security, if they feel secure, then you know they will have more money to spend on, you know, things they don't need to survive. And so if they, you know, people have things like universal basic income, healthcare, guaranteed housing, and they still work a job, guess what? Now all that disposable income can go off to go buy more capitalist things for our capitalist overlords.
Right.
And they can stay happy. So, you know, yeah, it really, you know, it is quite beneficial for so many reasons not to have people in jail and to pay them a living wage and have everyone have basic needs. Like, yeah, it absolutely does benefit everyone. And, you know, everyone as a society can be good and well off and comfortable and not just like 50 people who are billionaires.
Right. And well, yeah, not to get too off topic too, because that made me think about this, but what Republicans have done is defund the police more recently. And what we've seen with, you know, the COVID stimulus, which, you know, I guess we'll see where that is at
this
point.
We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, what we've seen is that there was a huge cut in money to support local government. And when we talk about supporting local government, we're talking about essential workers. We're talking about police, firefighters, etc. And so when you cut that money, you're defunding the police. And so not only are you going against what you say you stand for, which is law and order and supporting the police, but you're also defunding the police in a way that's not strategic at all, in a way that is not taking the funds and putting them to better use. You're just defunding the police, but then acting like you're not doing that. So not to get too off topic, but I just thought that was really interesting, is that as we see these same people that are saying, you know, the progressives, they want to ruin your suburban lives, and they just, you know, they want to get rid of law and order, and everything's going to be crazy, and they're going to burn down cities. These are the same people that are cutting funding to the police that, you know, that they say that they are supporting, that they have put on this pedestal, I guess. Yeah. So just something interesting to maybe talk to your family about, especially those that like to bring up defund the police. Just put that in your back pocket. But I guess we'll see what happens with that stimulus bill. And, you know, once again, 2020 is coming to an end, so wanted to kind of talk about goals and wanted to share goals with you all, and in a way to kind of like spark some ideas and also keep ourselves accountable. Maybe, you know, what are we looking forward to learning and doing in 2021, and, you know, how are we going to go about doing that? And, you know, obviously we can check back in and talk about that, but before we kind of jump into that, I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for listening. It's been really great to get together with Mallory and talk about these issues. It's been great to hear from people, you know, hear their opinions, listen to their questions, talk about the topics. And, you know, we'd like to continue to have these conversations. So if you have any questions or you have any topics that you'd like to hear us chat about more, send those to our email address, which will be in the pod show notes, as well as, you know, respond via Instagram, etc. All of that will be in the notes. So we'll go ahead and get to our goals. And for 2021, I have several goals. But one of the more, I guess, important goals that I kind of wanted to focus on is, one, to learn more about my genealogy. Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about this a lot in the past. And I feel like the more that you learn about your family and where they've come from and, you know, the struggles that they had to face, et cetera, it's interesting to learn about those things. And it puts a lot of things into perspective in my own life. And I think it's also been a really big catalyst for me because I've seen the kind of things that my ancestors have had to live through. And, you know, what a privilege it is for me to be growing up, you know, in 2020. And it really kind of gives me, you know, gives me hope and energy to kind of continue once again to kind of work towards the things that I think are important that will make our lives better, Americans as a whole and the world as a whole. And I think that reaching out to those people, I've learned a lot of really great things about my family and the type of people that we come from. And I hope that, you know, a lot of people out there too can kind of try to reach out and kind of learn more about their families. You know, it's really hard when you have African-American ancestry and things like that to kind of trace that kind of stuff. And so I know that that can be kind of a hard thing for a lot of people, but it's been something that I've been really interested in exploring more. And so I'll be doing that in 2021. And I also want to learn more about reparations. Yeah, I've read a lot of really interesting research on reparations, different ideas on like policies and how it can be enacted and things like that. So I kind of want to continue to explore that area. For a lot of people, like as you're learning more about social justice, as you're learning more about different folks' plights, certain topics start to come into your conversations that you hadn't talked about before. You know, until this year, I had never really thought about reparations and what that might mean and the positive impact, kind of like defund the police. It's something that people could hear, you know, even like affirmative action. And, you know, it's has a, you know, negative connotation or, you know, people don't know what to think about it. And so I'm looking forward to kind of exploring that a little bit more. And I'd love to do a podcast about it once I get a little bit more education and information on that from people that, you know, study that kind of stuff and know about those kind of things. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking forward to for 2021.
I think what I'm most looking forward to for 2021 is getting involved locally here in Denver with like a mutual aid group or some sort of organization or community that's doing something and working locally in the community, because like we've talked about before, like this can be like so overwhelming and seem like so much bigger than you. When that's not the case at all. And like, you know, there's so much going on locally that, you know, affects your life day to day more than you realize. So I've been sort of like trolling through some like Instagrams of like mutual aid groups in the area and like trying to like see like, okay, who are they following? And like trying to like go down that rabbit hole until I find one that like appeals to me or that's like really close to me or whatever it might be. So yeah, I really want to just become more involved, like in the community out here. And like, that's never really been sort of my personality before. I don't know if it was like, you know, COVID and like, you know, lockdown and isolation and not being able to leave the house or anything, but like, I just really want to be involved in the community. Like I want like stab me with this vaccine and put me out in the community.
Yeah, I know COVID has done a lot of different things for us. Yeah. I would say that I'm ready to kind of get out there soon and to kind of get involved in different ways too. And I'm an introvert, so.
Yeah. Hard same, as you know.
Yeah. Well, once again, thanks to everybody for listening to the pod. And we hope that you have a wonderful, safe, fun New Year's and that we see you in the upcoming year.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks y'all for listening. This was fun. I enjoy it. Like doing the podcast regularly has been like a good highlight this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say the same thing too. It's been fun. Thanks for doing it with me.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right, everyone. Bye.
Bye.